Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. He is certainly a first-class man who awakens and understands, either by himself or from others, the falsity and misery of this material world, and thus leaves home and depends fully on the personality of Godhead residing within his heart. Please repeat. He is certainly a first-class man.
He is certainly a first-class man.
Who awakens and understands. Either by himself or from others. The falsity and misery
of this material world.
And thus leaves home. And depends fully on the personality of Godhead. Residing within his heart.
Okay, Prabhus. So I'm going to mute everybody on pre-conferencing. Press star 6 if you want to unmute yourself during the class. And
Ramanuji, if you'll do the purport, please.
Oh, sure. No problem. And for those on Skype directly, please mute yourselves. Okay, now hold on just one second here. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. There are three classes of transcendentalists, namely, one, the dhīra, or one who is not disturbed by being away from family association. Two, one in the renounced order of life, a sannyasi, by frustrated sentiment. And three, a sincere devotee of the Lord who awakens God consciousness by hearing and chanting and leaves home depending completely on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who resides in his heart. The idea is that the renounced order of life, after a frustrated life of material sentiment in the material world, may be the stepping stone to the path of self-realization. But real perfection of the path of liberation is attained when one is practiced to depend fully on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who lives in everyone's heart as Paramatma. One may live in the darkest jungle alone, out of home, but a steadfast devotee knows very well that he is not alone. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is with him, and he can protect his sincere devotee in any awkward circumstance. One should therefore practice devotional service at home, hearing and chanting the holy name, quality, form, pastimes, entourage, etc., in association with pure devotees. And this practice will help one awaken God consciousness in proportion to one's sincerity of purpose. One who desires material benefit by such devotional activities can never depend on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although he sits in everyone's heart. Nor does the Lord give any direction to persons who worship him for material gain. Such materialistic devotees may be blessed by the Lord with material benefits, but they cannot reach the stage of the first-class human being, as above mentioned. There are many examples of such sincere devotees in the history of the world, especially in India, and they are our guides on the path of self-realization. Mahatma Vidura is a great devotee of the Lord. Is such a great devotee of the Lord, and we should all try to follow in his lotus footsteps for self-realization.
Thank you, Ramananda. Om Agena Timirandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshur Om Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namaam Vishnu Vadaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Itanamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pricharani Nirvishesha Shoni Vari Paskachade Shitani Vanja Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vieva Cha Patitanang Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So we're continuing on reading about the compassionate Vidura, who has returned home in order to deliver his elder brother, from slipping down into the clutches of material nature and not utilizing the great treasure he has in his human form of life. I was speaking yesterday at the end of class to Goda Chandra Prabhu, who also has an elder brother that is of need of help and has also shown his interest in spirituality and a little attraction to Krishna. And this is so much our duty. It was stated by Rishabhdev to his son, I believe Rishabhdev to his sons, the famous verse, Guru na sasyat, svajano na sasyat, pita na sasyat, janani na sasyat, daivan na tatsyan na patish na sasyan, namochi dat samupetam rityum. So this is stated that one should not become guru na sasyat. One should not become a guru. One should not, and this is what applies to Goda, in the case of his brother, svajana. Svajana means own people, or in this case, relative. One should not even be a relative. Guru na sasyat, svajano na sasyat, pita. One should not be father, janani. One should not be mother, daivang. One should not accept the post of a demigod, and patish. One should not be a father, namokshya yat samupetam rityum, namokshu, unless you can free them. Samupetamatrum, from the clutches, from the entanglement in the repetition of birth and death. It's kind of interesting that when we read this translation, as Prabhupada's translated, we really have to see it as we do pretty much always when we're reading any little aspect of our philosophy. We have to see it from a global perspective. If we see everything with blinders and don't see all of the scriptures and everything that Prabhupada has taught us and everything we've learned, it's very, very easy to take something out of context and misconstrue. So in this verse, it's saying, one who awakens or understands either by himself or by the help of others means they've properly heard. So we can understand that with the global understanding is that no one by his own self can awaken his true spirituality and understand Krishna from within by his own endeavor. What he's speaking of here when he's saying one who awakens or understands by himself or by others, it's understood herein that Vidura is speaking to Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra was from a great family. And just like by the association of Goda Chandra, his brother Joe has heard, he's had good association. He's been given books. He's been given all kinds of help in spiritual life. But yet in this particular case, it seems like he needs a little bit of help. But nobody starts by themselves, independently, with nothing, and obtains perfection. It can't happen. But if one hears properly, he can either get it himself, or often a little extra help is needed, as we see in this particular case here. I can give you a practical example, a mundane example. I was attending a seminar. I attended actually quite a few in Photoshop, which is a very sophisticated program of manipulation of graphics on a computer. And quite frankly, I'm not that technical. I don't have a mind for the computer world for some reason. I mean, I do okay, but the level of I guess conditioning or something that it seems that the younger people have that have sort of grown up in the computer age, they pick up on things so quickly. So when I would go to these seminars, every time I would take one of my younger photographers that works with me that gets it the first time, And I remember I would say, Josh, listen, I'm going to pay. It was like $100 per person. I said, Josh, I'm going to pay for myself and I'm going to pay for you too. But what you got to promise to do is after the seminar, when we go back home, you've got to explain it all to me because I'm only going to get a small percent of it. And a lot of what I understand, I'm going to have confused. But because he's got a better mind for it, he was able to understand it. And then with a little help, after he's explained it, then I can sort of get it. So it's important we understand that from the beginning, there must be some connection with sadhus, saintly persons, in order for us to begin advancing in spiritual life. It doesn't begin alone. Just like, for example, in the first, the very first text of the Bhagavatam, after Srila Vyasadeva offers his respects to the Lord, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, first I offer my respects unto, you know, my darling Lord, Sri Krishna, the son of Vyasadeva. Then he begins to explain, Janmadyasya yato anvayad itaratas charteshva bigat sarat. So he's explaining that, my dear Lord, you are the cause of all causes. You are the cause of the creation and destruction of all the manifested universes. Anvayad itaratas, both directly and indirectly, abhigyat svarat, you are conscious of everything, but yet, svarat, you are completely independent. And then he goes on to explain about how knowledge is received, and he begins with, or he continues on with, tene brahma hridaya adhikavaye muyanti yatsurya. He explains that, knowledge was understood, tene means imparted, tene brahma. This divine knowledge, Brahma means knowledge, or Vedic knowledge in this case, tene brahma hrida, from within the heart, ya adi kaviye, to the adi kavi, the first created being, muyanti yat suryaha, who like suryaha, like all the great sages and even demigods, muyanti, without being imparted from within the heart, one simply remains muyanti, illusioned. So we totally reject the process of ascending knowledge in spiritual life. We've many times discussed the four defects, that one has imperfect senses, one has a tendency to be illusioned, one makes mistakes, and one has a cheating propensity. So even materially, we can, what to speak of spiritual, even materially we can see how imperfect our senses are. When I'm working often on my computer in Photoshop, sometimes manipulating things as tiny as a pixel. And I'm always, I put my glasses, I certainly can't see without my glasses. So I put my glasses on, and then I've got a big stack of these little wipers with special chemicals to clean my glasses. The tiniest speck in front of my glasses makes it such that I can't see. And then every several months, I've got to go to the doctor to get a new set of glasses because they're constantly changing. So this is our imperfect senses. So just hearing without hearing from the pure devotee or some form of surrender, we will never, ever understand. Just like in India, if you go to talk, the common person in the street practically, oh, yes, I know Krishna, I know Rama. Yes, I know we are not the body. We are Brahman. Yes, I know Maya. Yes, I know repetition of birth and death. But yet they're mad after sense gratification. They've heard, but they didn't get it. They either need to hear from the perfect source, or they certainly need some help. So here, Vidura is certainly not whitewashing the truth. Taking advantage of the situation in which Dhritarashtra's in, where his body is now falling apart, loose teeth, failing organs, memory is starting to go. So now, in this condition, having previously heard, now with a little bit of help, hopefully, as we'll read on and see how this works and does turn out good, he is now able to hear with the help of his brother. But one has to be completely convinced of the falsity of material nature and the futility and the miseries that are all associated with sense gratification. Because if we can't give up the attachment to sense gratification and sinful life, we'll never become freed from illusion. This is in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yesham Tvandaka Papam Jananam Punya Karmana Te Dvandva Moha Nirmukta Bhajate Mandridavata. Krishna says that only those Tvandaka Papam who have actually Antigatam, who've completely eradicated or given up papam, sinful activity, and jananam punya karmana. And one turns their life around and begins engaging in spiritual activities, then te dvandva moha nirmukta, then they can become freed from dvandva, which is duality, and moha, delusion. And then bhajatenam dridhavata, what will follow when one becomes freed from that bondage of illusion, one who was wise and fortunate, bhajante mam dridhavata, then Krishna says, then one will engage with great dridhavata, with great firm determination, bhajante, engage in service unto me. Now, Prahlad says the same thing in the famous verse, which we many of us know, where he's the famous verse about chewing the chewed, where Prahlad says, Materna Krishne Paratakshvadova. He's actually taking the opposite of what's being said here. Not exactly the opposite, saying the same thing, but in the flip side of the coin, where he's saying, Materna Krishne Paratakshvadova, which means Materna Krishne, inclination towards a surrender to Krishna. Materna Krishne Paratakshvadova. That means paratat and svatava, by the help of others or by one's own self. Parata and svata, by one's own endeavor. So with the help, by one's endeavor and the help of others, mito, which means combined together, or both of them, abhipadyeta griha vritanang, which means abhipadyeta means to develop. Griha vritanan, that because one is attached or addicted to sense growth, griha vrata, then it'll never take place. It will not happen as long as that attachment is there. And the reason is, he explains further, adanda gobir, because adanda, which means uncontrolled or untamed, adanda gobir, because of the uncontrolled senses, vishatam tamisam. Vishuddha means to enter, and tamisnam means into hellish life. Punak punash charvita charvananam. One simply chews the chewed. Bhavadora is here hoping that by his words, if Dhritarashtra is able to hear free himself from engaging in continuing the last of his life in sense gratification. This sense gratification simply, it like packs the ear so you can't hear. It fills the ears with wax. He's, of course, trying to melt away that wax as a perfect doctor might do. If you go to the doctors and your ears are clogged up with wax, the doctor will use special tools in order to clean it all out so the hearing comes back again. And so Vidura is trying to remove that insidious wax and help him understand that what he's holding on to by trying to remain in a comfortable situation is, as Queen Kunti says, Janmaisvarya Shuti Shibir, Edamadak Madak Puman, Naivarhat Yabihatung Vai, Tomekinshin Agoshara. Queen Kunti describes that only those who have who are not maddened, Janma Aishvarya Shruti Shribir, high birth, education, beautiful body, these things madden one. And she says that Krishna can only be approached, Akinchana Gochara, by one who is materially exhausted. Swayambhuva Manu, he had a daughter who lived in great, great opulence. Swayambhuva Manu, of course, is the one of the 12 Mahajans. Svayambhur, Naradakshambhu, Komaram, Kapilo, Manu, Prahlado, Janako, Bhishmo, Baliya, Vayasikir, Vriyam, who fully understood the purpose of human life, even though he lived in opulence. And his daughter, his beautiful daughter, Devahuti, lived with him in a palace of jewels and precious metals and pawns and maid servants It's described that she never even experienced an inconvenience. Her life was so opulent and protected. But in order that she did not remain intoxicated by material comforts, she wanted her to obtain perfection, and therefore he made an arrangement to give her to the very austere sage, Kardama Muni. And now, Kardama Muni, he had been practicing for the very beginning of the Satya Yuga. He'd been practicing for 10,000 years. He was in very, very deep and austere meditation in order to perfect himself. And also within his heart, there was also the desire to serve Krishna in a particular way. I believe he was actually instructed by... was it Narda? Anyway, he was instructed as his service to create progeny. So part of his meditation was that he was actually praying in order to have great children. So anyway, he was living in a dark, lonely jungle. So the father of Devahuti arranged. He took her in a very, very opulent, beautiful chariot with men and horses and traveled to the jungle where where the meditation was taking place. And he gave his daughter to Kardama Muni and instructed her. He said, "Now, my dear, you serve very faithfully your husband," and which she did. And of course, serving him faithfully means that, you know, if he doesn't eat, she doesn't eat. You know, she would always wait. The etiquette would be to wait until the husband has eaten. But sometimes Kardama Muni, he wouldn't eat for weeks or even months. But she served very, very faithfully. And he would sit in samadhi for long, long periods of time, fasting. There was no house. They were completely subjected to the elements. But yet, with great faith and devotion, she served her husband. And so at some point, when he came out of one of his very, very long meditations, he saw his wife, and she was completely, by now, subjected to the elements and fasting and so on. Devahuti had become so emaciated that she was very, very skinny. Her hair was completely matted. Her body was just covered with dirt. She wore a very meager dress of an ascetic. It's described her breasts were even all discolored. And but of course, Kardama Muni knew her desire was to have a child. So he created for her. I mean, the mode of goodness was so prominent where they were, he had to create some different situation where at least the mode of passionate appeared to be more prominent. So he created aerial mansion it's described that he was such a powerful mystic that he created a mansion that was so opulent that even that it was incomprehensible even to the demigods. I mean, this was a mansion with parks and lakes and gardens and maid servants. It was seven stories high. It was described, it was just like, when it was in the sky, it was just like the moon. It was so beautiful. And he was able to travel anywhere in this. It didn't even require a pilot to travel. But his wife was so jaded from the austerities that she'd been undergoing with her husband that Kardama Muni, he instructed her to enter into Bindusarovara, which is the lake where his hermitage was at the lake of Bindusarovara. And by the way, Bindusarovara was a lake that was formed when Vishnu came and understood the purpose of Kardama Muni's meditation, desire to have a daughter, daughters and sons. But he was so, the Lord was so pleased and so compassionate that he began to cry, and his tears formed this huge, very beautiful and very opulent lake, Bindusarovara. So anyway, Kardama Muni instructed her to go ahead and swim to get your luster back, to dive into Bindusarovara, which she did. And because of his mystic powers, he created, as soon as she dove in, there was a huge house that had, get this now, it had 1,000 Gandharva ladies that were there to help bring her luster back. Now, I mean, this is a little inconceivable. If you were getting, somebody was going to bathe us or massage us, and, it's hard to think of more than 2 or 3 people bathing and massaging. But there was 1,000 of them. Inconceivable. But anyway, they bathed her with oils, and they adorned her in beautiful silken clothing. They gave her pearls and beautiful tilak. She was given a girdle to make her form especially beautiful, that was made of gold. So she was given so much. And so then they traveled, and she went now, and she joined her husband, Kardama Muni, and they began traveling, I mean, enjoying sense gratification like you could never imagine. They, this transcendental traveling mansion, he went to the groves, the gardens of Kuvera. Just like if you want to go on a nice vacation, you might go where somebody's very rich. Now, who's richer than Kuvera? So we went into the valleys of Kuvera, and it's described that they enjoyed sense gratification for many, many, many years. And in order to please her, once again, he drew upon his mystic powers, and Kardama Muni expanded himself 9 times. Prabhupada describes that a woman is 9 times lustier than a man. Now, I think in this day and age, in the age of Kali, I should say even in the age of Kali, I think men are certainly more, at least as promiscuous. They certainly appear to be more promiscuous than women in general. But when it comes down to the actual act of engaging in sex, I mean, it's pretty much undeniable that women have much more facility to enjoy prolonged sex than a man does. I mean, a man will generally have one orgasm and he really can't go on from there. But women can have multiple orgasms. So anyway, he, in order to satisfy her, expanded himself 9 times. And from these 9 different expansions, she had 9 beautiful, wonderful daughters, ultimately all of which were married to great sages and rishis. So anyway, and also when he inseminated her, it took only one day for her to have all of her 9 daughters. So then having satisfied her in that way. Kardama Muni actually wanted to leave now and go back off to the forest. And Devahuti, of course, implored him that, you know, my dear husband, you are so advanced in spiritual life. You know, how will I be protected? And she was begging for someone to protect her if he was going to go. So he told her that she would have one last child from his semen. And, of course, that was Lord Kapiladev, who came to give her shelter and enlighten her. So I'm going to read a little bit here what Devahuti, what she said about all the great sense gratification that she had in her life. And by this, by the wisdom of her father, who had put her in the situation of living in austerities and experiencing some of the difficulties, even though she engaged in great sense gratification, she was never attached to it. And let's read what she says here. She's now speaking to Kapiladev. She says, I am very sick of the disturbance caused by my material senses. For because of this sense disturbance, my Lord, I have fallen into the abyss of ignorance. Your Lordship is the only means of getting out of the darkest regions of ignorance, because you are my transcendental eye, which by your mercy only I have attained many, many births. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the origin and the Supreme Lord of all beings. You have arisen to disseminate the rays of the sun in order to dissipate the darkness of ignorance of this universe. Now be pleased upon me to dispel my due to my feelings of false ego. I have been engaged in your Maya and have identified myself with the body and consequent bodily relationships. I have taken shelter of your lotus feet. You're the only person of whom to take shelter. You are the axe that can cut the tree of material existence. Therefore, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, who is the greatest of all transcendentalists. And I inquire from you as to the relationship between man and woman and matter and spirit. So we have to, like Devahuti, had this great realization. And as Vidura is trying to give to Dhritarashtra, we have to become convinced of the falsity and the misery of this material world. Because if we don't become actually convinced, not just theoretical, but conviction within our heart, if we don't see the misery of this material world, then we can never inquire in earnest about the absolute truth. And we have to understand, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that from the highest planet to the lowest, they are all places of misery. It's described as wet stool and dry stool. Wet stool and dry stool. What is the difference? It's all stool. Demoniac philosophy in this day and age tries to teach one that if you're experiencing some type of miseries, that it's going to get better. And just hang on and try to see the good in all the miseries, which is the exact opposite of spiritual psychology. When we see something bad happening, we say, ah, so now, Krishna, you're very merciful to me. You're showing me the naked form of material nature. And if something's very good is happening, then we know it's just it's also just illusion. And if it seems good, it's not going to last because it's going to be temporary. So Prabhupada says that in this world, there is nothing but misery. There's the famous quote in Hawaii when the devotees were walking on the beach one day. It was a beautiful, beautiful sunny day. The surf was rolling and the people were out surfing, and Prabhupada looked, and the devotee said, "The surfers, Prabhupada," and or Prabhupada said something like, "What are they doing?" And they said, "Surfers." And Prabhupada said, "No, sufferers." Even Hawaii, with all of its beauty and all of its Svarga-like qualities from the age of Kali, we have to be convinced that it is nothing but a place of misery. We've got to see that misery all around us and understand the blazing fire in which we are at this time. Just like we chant in the morning to the spiritual master. One second here. I'm going to move my chair. The kitties are attacking. So anyway, we're praying to the spiritual master. Samsara Davana Lalita Loka Tranaya Karuna Gunaganatvam Pratasya Kalyana Gunanavasya Vande Guroshri Charanaravindam. That this world, Samsara Davana, Davana, a forest of fire, blazing forest of fire. Samsara Davanala Lida. Lida means afflicted. Loka. This world is afflicted. It's nothing but a blazing fire of material existence. We've got to see that. If we can't see around us every day the fire, the blazing fire of material existence, how will we ever take shelter of Krishna? Just like in Braj, just after the killing of the Kaliya serpent. No, not killing. Subduing. Actually, he wasn't killed. He was subdued. But we all remember that amazing Leela when Krishna was chastising Kaliya because of the venomous pool, this venomous lake that he had that was so toxic. It was killing the trees and animals for many, many miles around. And the inhabitants of Vrindavan, of Braj, were very fearful to go in that area. So Krishna went to have some transcendental fun and subdue the demon. And when Krishna went, he became, after a little bit of fighting back and forth, in order to transcendentally put the devotees in a transcendental state of humor, Krishna allowed that the Kaliya serpent wrapped him in his coils. And it's described that when Krishna became wrapped in those coils, all the residents of Vrindavan, but first of all, they saw, even those that weren't there, so many inauspicious things were happening. Meteors were falling from the sky. People were, their bodies were trembling on the left side. All kinds of inauspicious things were happening, and fear began to strike everyone's heart. And then when they finally saw that Krishna was encoiled in the body of a Kaliya serpent, they didn't even, it's described in the 10th canto that they didn't even want, they were practically dead. They had practically, they were just on the edge of death. Could you imagine in this world if someone you love, and what to speak of Krishna, but some mundane person, imagine a mother seeing her child, say, for example, in the mouth of a crocodile. And you just couldn't imagine what it would do to her heart. And Krishna remained there for 2 full hours. He was within the coils. And finally, seeing that the residents could not live anymore in that condition, then Krishna finally broke out and began dancing. And it was a wonderful transcendental display. But at any rate, after this, imagine how exhausted everyone was. So after Kaliya was subdued and he was sent away, saved by the plea of the Nagapatnis, the Gopas and Krishna, they all laid down completely exhausted at the bank of the Jamuna. And they were lying down under the stars. It was a beautiful night. But then all of a sudden they woke up, and there was fire everywhere, in every direction. I mean, fire that we couldn't even imagine within this world. Fire that was greater than the fire at the time of devastation. I mean, there was flames everywhere. And what did the cowherd boys do? They simply prayed, Krishna, Krishna, protect us. Krishna, protect us from this blazing fire. Krishna, Krishna, Mahabaho, my dear Krishna. We have no other shelter but you. We have no other shelter but you. And seeing their surrender and their dependence upon Krishna. And then Krishna opened up his mouth and he simply swallowed up all the fire and saved them. So we have to have this conviction, this realization of seeing the true falsity of this material world, and understand the precarious, worse than precarious, the dangerous position that we are in, with death coming quickly upon all of us, even the youngers who are in our Sangha. Death is coming quickly. We've got to recognize that samsara all around us and see the futility in sense gratification. Because if we can't see what Vidura was pointing out to Dhritarashtra, then we will never, ever be able to completely and fully surrender to Krishna. So anyway, these are some points, and I guess I'm way past my time. So we'll stop here, and we do still have a few minutes left for questions or comments.
Okay, I've unmuted everybody on free conferencing. So, any questions or comments?
Additions, corrections?
I had a question for you.
Okay.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on the purport about the three different types of transcendentalists? They almost seem, well, they seem very similar, but the differences...
Well, they are similar, and I don't think without really reading it and meditating on it, I could elaborate too much. But I can simply say that the purport of all of that, I think he's describing really that the highest, whether one is not disturbed at all, one is completely dira, one who takes sannyas out of frustration, which is certainly a good thing to do. If one is realizing it's miserable and he's in a frustrated sentiment, at least he's moving in the right direction. There may be different stages or different levels by which one is trying to free himself from attachment to opulences or sense gratification within this world. Everybody's at a different level. But the bottom line is that one who ultimately completely depends upon Krishna within his heart, that's the highest of all. And again, globally, by reading all of Prabhupada's books, we can understand that it doesn't matter whether one is a sannyasi or whether one remains in household life. Just like Korma Brahman, when Lord Chaitanya was traveling in South India and Korma Brahman wanted to leave his home and leave his family and renounce everything and take sannyas and simply join Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya instructed him, no, stay home. Yeah, jare dako tari koho Krishna upadesh amara gyai guru hiyai tara edesh. Simply stay in your home and practice Krishna consciousness. So I would say that is really what we need to understand rather than the details of this type of sannyas or that type of sannyas. That's the highest. This is the real anashrita karma palang karyan karma karotiya. Sanyasi, the yogicha, nanyaragnya, the chakriya. Krishna describes who the real sannyasi, who the real mystic is in the Bhagavad Gita. Anashrita karma palam, one who's not attached to anything, he's not attached to the results of the karma or the fruits, karma palam. Anashrita karma palam, one who's not attached to any fruits of anything within this world, but simply engages in the service of Krishna. He is the ultimate sannyasi, and he is the true mystic, and he is the highest of all.
Okay.
Anyone else? Let me see if I can find that. I came across...
Hey,
Madan!
I was thinking of... Adibol, with Ramananda's question, there's a distinction between a Narottama and a Dira. And you,
okay,
you described it. I think it's in this the chapter that we're discussing now, that Dhritarashtra, he wouldn't become a Narottama, but he could become a Dira. So there's different distinctions on the transcendentals. Generally, it's something impersonal or mystic. It's a different it doesn't have the engagement with Krishna, but it's out of the material energy.
Hmm.
I think it's going to come up in one of the verses fairly soon.
It almost seems to me like it sounds like a sannyasi is less than a dhira, you know, because if you're undisturbed, whereas like a sannyasi, it says, is one who's frustrated, has a frustrated sentiment, and like, just forget it, I'm out of here. That's what it sounds like.
Well, that's that particular, just giving a few examples. I mean, there are sannyasis. I mean, Prabhupada was a sannyasi. Many sannyasis are completely pure devotees, but there's all different levels of sannyas. But one who takes sannyas responsibly, even in a mood of frustration, he's frustrated with material nature, but he's trying to detach himself. That's certainly a good step in the right direction. And I'm saying responsibly taking sannyas.
Of course, the example of the Dira is Lord Shiva. He's always referred to generally, but I think in this particular verse, it's referring to something, as you pointed out, kind of technical, and it'll become clear probably within the next week. There'll be a verse that'll explain that part of it, but it's kind of a technical point.
Okay.
I could also add that I talked a lot about a devotee that we have to see the miseries, all the miseries everywhere, blazing fire within this material existence. And I talked about how, you know, whether something is good or something is bad, a devotee doesn't take any real joy in it. If something's bad, we're not, you know, too depressed about it. In fact, we see the good in it, and something's really good. We know it isn't going to last, and we see it as an allurement or maya. But it's not, for the devotee, it's not that it's all misery. When we begin practicing spiritual life, devotees, even at our stage, we actually do begin to experience transcendental pleasure, the pleasure of chanting Krishna's names. I mean, we must admit there's some wonderful pleasure in chanting, even at our stage, you know, albeit very neophyte and just the beginning. Or this Bhagavatam class. Nobody has to be here, but we're all relishing this sangha of coming together and hearing the Bhagavatam. What joy! The association of devotees is so pleasurable. Reading Prabhupada's books, our study, the deities, kirtan. It's not that we aren't with pleasures. We experience great pleasures. And it's just going to get better and better and better and better as our hearts become pure and pure.
Two things that I just remembered is that in the process of knowledge, Bhagavad Gita, 13:8-12, that's the famous place where it says, Janma Mritya Jara Vadi, that one should see the evil of birth, death, disease, and old age.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's...
Yes.
There's one nice devotee, he's always saying this verse in Sanskrit, but it means everywhere he only sees happiness. Wherever he looks, he always sees his happiness. That's a devotee.
Well, when we see birth, death, old age, and disease, we see it as Krishna's mercy. I mean, obviously, Vidura saw the wonderful blessing of old age that had come to Dhritarashtra, his brother. He couldn't enlighten him otherwise, apparently. He didn't get it. Now, in his old age, we can see the beauty. We can see the beauty of birth and death and old age and disease to ultimately frustrate. Just like if a parent is chastising a child, another parent can see the beauty of it and understand that it's all out of love, because it is all Krishna's love. It's Krishna's love that there's death, and Krishna's love that there's birth, and Krishna's love that there's old age, and it's Krishna's love that there's terrible diseases and wars. It's all Krishna's love to make a plan to take us back to Godhead. We see nothing, a devotee sees nothing but Krishna's mercy.
What's that verse?
If we see it independent, but if we see it independent of Krishna, then we see it as a misery.
What about that verse, yes, yaham anuganami, as far as taking a sannyasa?
Krishna takes it all away. Yes, yaham anuganami, harasye tadanam shanai. Tato danam jajantyasya svajana dukha dukitam, that Krishna, it's described that his greatest stroke of mercy is when he takes everything away. Parasyeh, Tadanam, Tadanam, you're all of one's wealth and possessions. Tadanam Shanai, gradually takes it all away.
And then
it's described when you lose it, Tatodanam Tijuntyasya. And then when you are Adanam, Tatodanam, so then, or what follows, Adanam, when one is Adanam, has no opulences, all these things are taken away. Tatodanam Tijuntyasya, you are rejected, Svajana, by your own people, Dukadukitam, which cause more and more misery.
The Prabhupada explained that he has personal experience of this. When his business failed.
Yes, when his situation with his wife wanting to serve tea, and his business was not doing so well, he saw Krishna's blessings and Krishna's mercy and all of that, and that he quoted that many times when he was describing how he eventually took sannyas, saw Krishna's plan for.
He was telling that story in Los Angeles at an arrival address, and everybody started to laugh when he said that. And then Prabhupada said, it is not a laughing matter. But when it's happening, it's Krishna, he does what's necessary in special cases. Who can understand?
One interesting thing I read, there was some discussion in a class a week or so ago about the possibility that there were no trees in the Satyayuga. And I was reading here that this is a Satyayuga. This was the Satyayuga where this took place. And it's describing, not only is it described that there are trees, but it's described in the Bhagavatam in great, great detail about the trees. I printed some out. Let me read this. And then we'll end. Describing here, Kardama Muni, on the shore of the lake was a surrounding of cluster of pious trees and creepers, rich in fruit and flowers of all seasons, that afforded shelter to pious animals, birds, which uttered various cries. It was adorned with the beauty of groves from the forest. Purport. It is stated here, every tree bore fruits and flowers, and every bird sang the glories of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lake Bindusarovara was adorned by flowering trees such as Kadamba, Champak, Ashok, Karanja, Bakula, Asana, Kanda, Mandara, Kutaja, and young mango trees. The air was filled with pleasing notes of Karandava ducks, swans, ospreys, waterfowl, cranes, kitties are back, chakravakas, and chakuras. Purport. For most of the trees, flowers, fruits, and birds mentioned here as surrounded Bindusarovara, synonyms cannot be found. All the trees mentioned are very pious and produce nice aromatic flowers such as the champak, kadamba, and bokula. So anyway, I just found that interesting.
What about that reference that Mother Gandhari said, and then there was some Purana that you had looked up, and there was...
I did. I just found that interesting when she mentioned that in the class, and I just didn't know. I never heard it. So I searched the Veda base. At first, I couldn't find any reference to trees in Satyayuga. But then I looked and I found some obscure reference in the one of the Puranas, the Linga Purana, that something about the rain would come in the Treta Yuga, and then there would be trees and from trees shelter. So there was that kind of vague reference, but outside of Prabhupada's books. And I'm always a little cautious of anything outside, but here I just sort of stumbled upon it, that there was great, reference, very, very exacting, specific types of flowering trees and fruiting trees and how auspicious they were. And this is all in Satyayuga. In fact, this is not the end. This is the beginning of Satyayuga, where this Leela took place. So anyway, I'm just...
Sorry. Thank you again for bringing up I should just add, I did mention that this was mentioned for the first kalpa, like Padma kalpa, and yes.
Oh, okay.
Rana. So, you know, at the first ever, then, you know, that it was different at different satyugas. And
see. That's interesting. Okay, that could be. That could answer it.
What is a Padma kalpa? What is that?
It's the time of creation, the first time. The first kalpa is the first 1,000 yuga cycle, or the first day of Brahma. And it's the first kalpa. It's the 4 yuga cycle, which is the first one ever. We are on the 28th yuga cycle right now.
I see. So this would happen when there was first creation of the entire universe.
Yes. So it's called the first kalpa, it's called the Padma kalpa. Padma kalpa, and then we are right now in the seventh month.
Where is this?
This is from the Purana, as I mentioned, the name of a devotee that was mentioning. I think it was, forget now his name, Shyamasundar. I just got an email from Varnashram conference. You can look it up. It's still there in the Varnashram conference, so... he took it from a Purana. So.
Okay. I mean, I find it interesting and stimulating, but I kind of think everything, you know, all the important stuff we need to know, that whatever we really need to know, that's all, and that's, we don't have to go outside of Prabhupada's books.
I know that's your opinion, but right now, even so many devotees are actually quoting or giving classes from the 6 Goswami books and Sanatan Goswami, Jiva Goswami, and of course all those. So right now, because there are some scriptures that Srila Prabhupada wanted us to study, and now if we are talking about implementing Varnashram, and then for Varnashram, we need to look at a lot of scriptures. Just like the creation of the Vedic planetarium, they had so many devotees help doing research from different Puranas to find the exact references for creating the Vedic planetarium. So, you know, they spend months and months doing the research from different Puranas and Shastras, you know, because Prabhupada's books are a condensed version for, especially the Bhagavatam, for Bhakti Yoga. But, you know, you will see.
I will maintain my opinion, as you call it, my opinion. That, I mean, I'll acknowledge it's interesting. But for myself, I will say my opinion that I don't really feel I need to go outside of Prabhupada's books. Everything we need to know is that he's given us. And interesting, yes, of some value, certainly. But for myself, I mean, I'm just not that smart. I'm not that intellectual, and I don't have much going for me. I'm kind of a simple person. I don't have a lot of time to... And I can barely read Prabhupada's books. I've read them a time or two, and you know, I don't have many years left. How many people? Who was it saying in class the other day that it was a Gaudachandra? I think said yesterday that Prabhupada said you could spend. What did he say? You could spend. Was it 50 years reading my 25 years reading my books? And at that time, all the books weren't even written. So I would personally rather spend my time reading Prabhupada's books, and that's for me. So and it is my opinion, but my opinion for myself, not being that smart or not that inclined, not that advanced a devotee, I'll just stick in the safe waters of Prabhupada's books.
I'd have to agree with you. Please, for me.
Anyway, like I said, it's my opinion, which and we're all entitled to our opinions. I think it's a shame that so few people read Prabhupada's books. Too often I see them, and again, this is my opinion, they divert off into all these other books that are being written, and they're not, the emphasis is not, it takes, quite frankly, it takes the emphasis away from Prabhupada. Prabhupada, who is the founder of Acharya, I'd say if you've read all of Prabhupada's books, and you know them well, and you're a scholar, then sure, you know, go. You may want to read further. But for myself, I can't even. I can read a chapter today, and a little while later, I can't even remember it. You know, what to speak of having gotten all the way through Prabhupada's books, you know, more than a couple of times. So if I read them once, I've pretty much forgotten what I've read, and I'll go back and read them again, and everything I need to know is of importance to get me back to Godhead, I'm certain, is right there. And plus, I feel Prabhupada's presence in his books. Prabhupada is actually present there to enlighten. Outside of Prabhupada's books, I don't feel Prabhupada's presence. I don't necessarily feel his blessings or his potency in reading something else. But when I open the Bhagavatam, I feel, with beyond any shadow of doubt in my mind, that Prabhupada is speaking to me right out of that Bhagavatam. And I just don't want to leave his lotus feet. So anyway, thank you all very much. It's we're way past time. Go ahead.
It supports your point in this purport. It talks about, I can't find the exact sentence, I wrote the note, in association of pure devotees. That's what you're saying when we're reading Prabhupada's books. We feel the association of a pure devotee, and that's where we make the advancement.
And that's a great point, in the association of pure devotees. Now, it's not that there isn't more than one pure devotee. There are many pure devotees, but Prabhupada is our connection. He is our guru, or he is our paramaguru. So it's Prabhupada. We have access to Prabhupada. We don't have access necessarily to, with such a perfect connection to others outside of Prabhupada. We are Prabhupada anugas. We are following Prabhupada's feet. And I was there in India in 1974, when devotees first started going into the town of Vrindavan, and like kids in a candy shop, they were finding all these books by other acharyas, even in our line, our disciple chain, books of Bhakti Siddhanta. And Prabhupada chastised us severely for even reading Bhakti Siddhanta's books. Prabhupada said, how are you going to understand them? I can hardly understand Bhakti Siddhanta. How will you understand them? So what to speak of people who are, you know, not in our line? We can't even understand Bhakti Siddhanta. So, you know, again, maybe there's others that are more advanced than me on another level, but I'm going to stick with, if I read it in Prabhupada's books, then that's there for me, and Prabhupada's there to explain and help. Anyway, so I got to run. Thank you all very much for your association, and see you all tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Jai Ramananda Ji, Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.
Shiva Prabhupada Ji.
Jai.